On this Thanksgiving week, I looked deep inside my soul and asked, what am I most thankful for? And you know what it was? The ribs. In all seriousness, I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and that this latest episode of the podcast shakes you out of your turkey-induced coma. This is the Creative Nonfiction Podcast, as you know, where I speak with the world's best artists about creating works of nonfiction, leaders from narrative journalism, memoir, essay, radio, and documentary film, and try to tease out the origins, habits, and routines that allow you to improve your own work. And for episode 77, I welcome Blair Briody. That's at Blair Briody on Twitter, B-L-A-I-R-E. B-R-I-O-D-Y. Blair Briody is a freelance journalist who has written for the New York Times, Popular Science, Popular Mechanics, Fast Company, Glamour, among others. Her first nonfiction book, The New Wild West, Black Gold, Fracking and Life in a North Dakota Boomtown, just came out this fall. The book was the 2016 finalist for the Lucas Work in Progress Award from Columbia Journalism School and Harvard University, and she received the Richard J. Margolis Award for Social Justice Journalism in 2014. She graduated from UC Davis with a degree in international relations and lives in Northern California now. Now, also, Blair won Proximity Magazine's second annual narrative journalism prize, and that's kind of what gets her on the podcast this week, for her piece, It Takes a Boom, which chronicles Cindy Marcello, the lone woman in the vast fracking sites in North Dakota. Ted Conover, author of several books and immersion journalist of the highest order, judged the contest. You can hear him back on episode 50 of the Creative Nonfiction Podcast. And here's what he had to say about Blair's gold medal piece. Quote, "This vivid portrait of a woman trying to work oil fields during the fracking boom rings totally true. We seldom meet people like Cindy Marcello in narrative journalism, but I don't doubt for a second they're here. I love the frankness and the matter-of-factness. Both Blair Briody and her subject won my heart and admiration," end quote. Nice. Speaking of being thankful, reviews and ratings have been flowing in, and I want to extend a big, big thanks to those who are doing that and taking advantage of my editing offer as a result. So what is this exactly? In exchange for an honest review, doesn't even have to be a good one, just an honest one, review on iTunes, I'm offering an hour of my time to work with you on a piece of writing. All you have to do is leave your review, and when it posts, email me a screenshot of it. As long as it's postmarked any time between November 2017 and the end of December 2017, the offer stands. Reviews are the new currency, and your help will go a long way toward building the community this podcast sets out to make, to empower others to pick up the pen or the camera or the microphone and do work that scratches that creative itch. Okay, now what? The first half of this interview actually had to be completely cut out. Hey, easy. Like, hear me out, please. Why? There were some nasty internet gremlins wreaking all kinds of havoc with our connection. It sounded like an old Apple computer chugging in the background, mixed in with some heavy thumps, maybe an aquarium aerator. I mean, that none of that actually happened, but that was kind of the sound going on. So, I mean, it was weird, but more than that, it was extremely distracting. So instead of putting you through that, fair listener, I'm going to sum up the first part of the interview in a few hundred words. Then we'll get to the second half that I recorded through a different connection that sounds just fine. Okay. So Blair was working at the Fiscal Times in New York City and heard about Williston, North Dakota, for one unique attribute. It had one of the lowest unemployment rates in the entire country. Thanks to the hydrofracking boom, workers flocked to North Dakota for the long hours and the hopes of six-figure pay. She traveled to North Dakota more or less on a whim. Getting access took time and rigor, essentially knocking on doors and finding balance of being interested without being too eager. Blair found one man who struck her as a great character, but by her own account, she was a bit stalkerish, wanting to follow him home and observe his wedding. A great scene, no doubt, but he stopped returning her calls, so Blair moved on. Eventually, she found Cindy Marcello, the main character in It Takes a Boom, by reaching out to a CNN reporter who had done a story on Marcello. In Blair's reporting, she favors recorders for the interviews and notebooks for observations. She said, quote, "I have to type up my notes at the end of the day because I can't decipher it myself," end quote. What drew Blair to journalism was being able to ask strangers questions that would normally seem rude in normal social context. Plus, writing the next great American novel felt too daunting, so nonfiction relieved her of needing to rely too heavily on imagination alone. To quote Maddie Blaze, reality was compelling enough. Blair knew early that news writing wasn't her thing. She wanted to do magazine features, but pitching was a challenge, so she took a class, a media bistro class on pitching. You know what? It worked. She worked on a story for that class about a young woman who was a math genius in a more or less all-male world, not unlike what Cindy Marcello was up to in North Dakota. And that's where we pick up the conversation, as we get into the weeds of how Blair crafts and sends out pitches. You'll also find out in this part of the interview what part of the process most engages Blair, how talent, by and large, is overrated, how the ordinary can become the extraordinary, and how Blair uses document maps to organize her reporting. A lot of good stuff. So if you stick around, you've got to be sick of me by now. So let's hear Blair Briody talk, and thank you for listening.
I was asking you about how you go about querying, and you were saying you like to go in with a little bit of some pre-reporting, which is really, really smart. And so just kind of elaborate on that and what that process looks like. At what point do you feel comfortable then pitching a story? And maybe even how do you do that pre-reporting, not knowing and lining up a source and saying, like, I don't know where this is going to land yet, but if you indulge me a little bit, I'll be able to maybe successfully pitch it after we've done a little bit of sort of pre-reporting. So, like, how does that manifest itself for you?
What I was saying before is I tend to have more success when I find the story first and then find a magazine that I think it'll fit in. And to me, again, I think it comes down to finding who the main character is going to be. Because for me, even as a reader, that sells me on a story pretty quickly if I'm engaged with who the person is. And then with the magazine, just giving, arguing your case for why the story is important now and sort of the larger context, and why it's timely and necessary to publish.
What would you say is your most successful cold pitch?
I would probably say, so after, I took that class through Media Bistro and I, worked on this feature story about the mathlete, the female mathlete, and then after, publishing that in this small magazine, Geek Monthly, I pitched my next story to the New York Times, and that was accepted. And that was a piece that I basically was in New York and I was riding the subway and I just observed this scene in front of me where this guy approached this girl and was trying to convince her to be a model. And he said he was a model scout. And she, at first, was a little standoffish, thought he was, was maybe a little creepy. But then ultimately she took his business card. And I just was just the observer, walking, I kind of followed them out of the subway for a few blocks. And and then I immediately when I got home, I just wrote up this scene that I had witnessed. And then basically just put, I think I did one quick interview after that with the actual model scout. And, you know, just did this pitch about, you know, who are these people? Like, is this an actual, you know, job path? Is this, are they legitimate? You know, how can people tell? So, you know, I was like, I had this scene. I had, you know, I did a little research by talking to a model scout. And, you know, I think I just included a quote from him in the pitch, and then just basically just said, I want to look into this more. I want to, you know, I have these questions about this industry and want to pursue this.
Awesome. Awesome. And when you had that conversation with that scout, did you say, I have this idea, I'm looking to pitch to the New York Times, or did you say that I have?
No, I think I just said, you know, I'm a writer. I'm curious about this industry. Can you tell me a little more about it? You know, I might pitch this somewhere. I was pretty vague about it. Sometimes with people, when I'm doing that initial research, I say, you know, I've written for these places before. I'm thinking about pitching it here or here. But yeah, back then I didn't really have a whole lot of clips. So I just said I was doing some research.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause, in my experience, sometimes some people just don't want to talk to me at all because they don't know who I'd be writing it for. But it's like, if you can bait them with a known media empire,
right,
and be like, oh, okay, right, well, this behooves me to talk to this person. But if you end up wanting to just do some research, like, I don't know where this is going to go. It might just be an essay for a literary journal. They might be like, meh. So,
right.
So I wondered, right, if like you had that in the holster.
Yeah, no, it can be more challenging when you don't have an assignment for some people to talk. But I think, you know, most people, if you just say that, you know, you're a freelance writer, you know, you kind of have to explain what that means because not everyone understands that. But that, you know, you're doing sort of the initial legwork for this story. That's usually how I try to frame it. Not totally sure where this is going yet, but, you know, you can still help me and hopefully, you know, it'll go somewhere. So.
Nice. Yeah, I like how you frame that. I'm just, you know, I'm a freelancer, or I'm an independent writer, you know, doing some initial framework. I'm hoping to land it maybe out of the, like, A, B, right, and C. But right, I need to do a little, it would be nice to speak to somebody first to give me a little more sort of, right, juice for it. That's great. Yeah.
Exactly.
So how do you vet out your stories, and, you know, what sinks there? What do you sink your teeth into, and what, as a result, like, kind of sinks its teeth into you as you pursue, yeah, a story and doesn't let go?
Yeah, I mean, I've written about quite a few different topics. So I would say topic-wise, I consider myself more of a generalist. But yeah, like what I said earlier, you know, just those stories that you can't seem to get away from, that you keep thinking about them. Those, I try to always pursue those when that's the case. And that's usually, you know, comes from either a story, someone telling you and you're just shocked by it or fascinated and you can't stop thinking about it. Or, like I said, like the setting, like in North Dakota, I was, you know, just so curious about what was actually going on there and what that setting was like. And then, so, yeah, sometimes it's an industry, like with the model scouts or, so yeah, there isn't necessarily just one factor that causes me to pursue a story, but usually it's just, usually I can't find that much else about it that's been written, or at least, you know, I can't find much out about the angle that I'm thinking about. And so.
Yeah. And it seems like you're partly drawn to, these women who are like deeply immersed in like very male dominated industry too, with the Mathlete,
definitely.
And Cindy.
I think, yeah, like interesting gender dynamics, I think, has always fascinated me, whether that's, being one of the few females or the only female, or, being in this environment where there's, you're constantly, you can't really get away from it. You're constantly thinking about like the gender dynamics. So.
And so when you were doing all of your reporting, say, for the book and or even a longer feature, when you get all that information, how do you start to begin to organize it so then it's accessible to you to then shape it into a story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the most challenging parts about it is coming home with, you know, reams of material and, you know, hours upon hours of interview tapes you have to transcribe. That's like a very, I think that's one of the hardest parts of the whole process. Very daunting. In North Dakota, I used just basically a Word document and doc. I don't know if you've ever used document maps.
No, Word. No. Tell me about it.
I show a lot of people this feature that is on Microsoft Word where you basically just create subheads through the document and you tag it so you can flip through easily, you know, just like a table of contents. And so, you know, the actual document, you know, in the end became like 300 pages, but, you know, I would just tag, you know, this is the interview, this is the date, this is, you know, the general topic of it. And then the actual transcription would be in a separate document. But then I could, you know, I had like story ideas in that document. I had people I wanted to call. I had, you know, some articles that I was reaching. I just kept everything in one document. That was a lot easier for me to be able to kind of see it all right there. And so then, yeah, I've tried to type up all my notes at the end of the day. So that helped. And yeah, and then it's just a lot of like, sorting through the pile and, you know, trying to figure out. Yeah, that's definitely a hard part. I think I still lost a lot of the time during that process.
So say you've got all your notes together. What's your next step? Do you choose to outline? Do you use a corkboard and index cards? Like, what does that process look as you go forward?
Yeah, I try to do like a very loose outline. I don't always stick to it. And I think for this book project with North Dakota, I don't know if it was the best process, but what I basically did was, you know, I had a summer of reporting. I worked on the book proposal. And then I needed to go back out and get more material. So I would come home from a trip out there, sort through all the material I gathered. I would write a chapter. You know, usually I was like, you know, if I was spending a lot of time with one or two of the people in the book, then I would focus, I'd be like, okay, I have more material for this section that I want to write about. So I'd work on that section, and then I would get to a point where I'd be like, well, now I need more material. And so I'd, you know, book another trip out to North Dakota and like spend another couple weeks out there and then come home and like do the same thing. I haven't heard of like of a lot of other people that have done it that way. I think most people try to get all their material first and then start writing. But for me, I think because I didn't totally know which direction I was going for a while, it helped me figure that out to do it that way.
And at what point did you feel comfortable to then tackle your book proposal, and what did that look like? You know, you had the previous book proposal experience, and then you were able to have this one.
Right.
So what? Right. You know, so what did you learn from the first experience, and then how did you start shaping the new one?
I mean, I think one criticism that a lot of book editors will give magazine journalists and freelance editors is that their book proposal feels like a magazine article, you know? And so that was some criticism I got in the first one, where it was basically mini magazine profiles on all these towns. Like, that's what the idea was. And so I knew that with the North Dakota book, I wanted more of these through lines of, you know, I didn't want it to just be, okay, here's this one character and here's like a, you know, standalone feature article and like a few chapters. And so yeah, I tried to have that come through in the book proposal, but you know, I wanted like the three lines were going to be this town, there was going to be me and my experience, and then I was going to have these various perspectives. I followed like five people who were all in different situations out there, and then you know, and they weren't just like a single chapter. They were, you know, throughout the whole book. I would weave their narratives together. So yeah, but the book proposal basically was one chapter that I wrote about Donnie Nelson, who is a farmer out in North Dakota who has a lot of oil wells on his land. And I thought that was a good example for the book proposal because it talked about, you know, the environmental aspects, about, I was able to talk about these changes that he's witnessed and what the state was like before. So I thought he was a good example to include in the proposal. And then, you know, just a detailed outline of how the rest of the chapters would be.
And like book proposals and pitches, you know, there's a degree of salesmanship involved there. What would you say are some best practices for people who might be struggling with landing pitches or even book proposal, which are far more like an intensive process, book proposal, but they're similar in nature in terms that you're trying to ultimately sell someone on something. So what have you found to be best practices involved in either or?
I mean, as far as the book proposal, for me, it was a learning process because I almost had to like unlearn the magazine pitching and writing process. It was like I kept getting that feedback that like this isn't a magazine article. You have to think differently, and like, you know, this is a you want this book to still be interesting and relevant like 10 years from now, and that was really hard for me to wrap my head around. You know, I'd just been trained for so long to be thinking about, you know, how to make this timely right now. So I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to think of good best practice for either one, but they're so different. So
yeah, I guess a lot of it comes down to more with magazine pitches versus book proposals is just repetition. Just do a lot of them and get a lot of rejections. Right.
And I actually, you know, I took a class too in New York about writing book proposals. So I think, I mean, that's always been helpful for me to get, you know, get feedback that way. And classes are really great because, you know, you have, you know, an assignment due every week. You know, you have to like keep working at it. So,
yeah. Would you say that maybe some people are a little gun shy about taking those kind of continuing ed classes and stuff? And how valuable would you say those were to your continued success as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, for me, they've been invaluable. So, but you know, I also the quality of class you get in New York was really great. I mean, the teacher that taught the book proposal class, you know, he was an agent at, you know, a major agency, and so to be able to get, you know, his expertise and his feedback was great. But, you know, there's a lot of that out there, like with conferences. And, you know, I think if you're in a place outside of New York City where there's not classes like that available, you know, you can go to workshops and stuff, travel to go to those.
Mm-hmm. And so with, you know, going to a fairly remote area in North Dakota for doing a big bulk of your reporting for your book and the piece that won you the prize. I suspect that even though you were, you know, interacting with a lot of the people out there, that you probably felt pretty lonely on some level too. And I wonder, like, maybe if that's true at all, like, how did you fight off that sense of loneliness and isolation and doubt while you were out there?
Yeah, no, that's always something I struggle with this work, is it does get pretty lonely. One thing I did in North Dakota, though, is I actually hired a photographer and a videographer to come out there just for, you know, I think they each came out for like 5 days. And that was really helpful because then, you know, I could talk to them about this work. I could, they, you know, stayed out in the trailer with me for a little bit. So, you know, I introduced them to a lot of the subjects that I was writing about. So, yeah, I think just, you know, finding ways to collaborate whenever possible, I guess.
What during the process, like where do you feel most alive? Yeah, is it the reporting stage, the writing phase, rewriting? Like, where do you feel most engaged?
Yeah, I mean, I love the reporting process, even though it's a lot of hard work. Just getting into great conversations with people, you know, that's kind of what it comes down to, and knowing when you you know, just like coming home from an interview and just feeling really excited about the material and. Just knowing that, you know, you have interesting material basically is a great feeling. As far as the writing process, for me, the first draft is pretty awful. that I don't like that part at all. It's like pulling teeth every single day to get stuff down. But then I like that part right after I have something, you know, I have a draft and, you know, almost like before you show it to anyone and you're like in that part of, okay, you have something down and now you have to clean it up and, you know, fiddle with it and tweak it and make it, you know, readable and ready to show someone else. I think I like that part because it's not, you know, before it becomes like a major revision, it's just, and you have something down. So.
And how do you define rigor and hard work and this line of work? You know, what are your metrics that when you look back at the end of the day, you know, you feel like, oh yeah, I accomplished a lot today?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of what it all comes down to is the hard work. You know, I don't know exactly like what to me, what is considered a successful day, because sometimes, you know, even though I was working all day, I don't feel like I really got anywhere, but that's part of the process.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, even, you know, I remember in college feeling, I would read these other, you know, some of my peers and some of their writing, and they seemed so talented. They just seemed like, you know, naturally just so talented at writing. And I remember thinking, you know, feeling jealous, not feeling like I have the same talent level. And so I remember thinking, okay, I just have to like outwork them. I have to work twice as hard as they do to be able to do this. And I think that's really served me because I followed some of their careers a little bit after college and a lot of them ended up not pursuing writing. So to me, I think that's what a lot of it comes down to is just doing the work.
Yeah, and there's a fine line between being, say, using that, being competitive with other people and then letting that turn into toxicity. It looks like you looked at them and had those little pangs of jealousy or competitiveness, but you turned it into, okay, you know what, maybe they might be a little more gifted than I am, but they're never going to be able to outwork me, so... Where did that come from? Like, how were you able to make that distinction in your mind and not let those black feelings get inside you and keep you from accomplishing great work?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think just, that's a good question. I'm not sure exactly what caused me to have that attitude, but yeah, I think I've just seen, you know, that talent is only a small part of the equation, and especially with journalism, because good reporting is good writing, and I think a lot of the people that I read, like Ted Conover and Joseph Mitchell, and all, like, you can tell that so much of the work was the reporting, that they, you know, just immerse themselves in these really interesting situations or around interesting people. And that's such a big part of what causes their work to come alive is, you know, relying on that interesting material, which you have to be able to get that, you have to do the work reporting. So I think probably being influenced by some of those other writers.
Yeah, when you figure out that that a lot of times these great long form pieces, they stem from having the liberty to spend a lot of time with a lot of people, and they speak to dozens and their phone going on in the background.
Yeah, sorry
right.
about that.
No, that's all right. I had like some panic attack that we were having another weird connection issue. And so,
oh, no, I think it just stopped.
All right. Yeah, so my point being is that a lot of the stuff is it's echoing your point that that these great profiles and features that they stem from such unbelievable feats of reporting and just talking to a lot of people, and you wonder, like, how did they get that material? Well, the fact is, they talk to a lot of people. And they ask this person, like, all right, who can I speak with now? And we like, they give you five people, and then it spreads exponentially from there. It's like, has that been your experience? Like, the more interviews and the more reporting you do, you're like, oh wow, this just keeps getting richer and richer.
Oh yeah, definitely. And just the time. I mean, you know, like what you said, like, spending the time with people. I mean, that, I think, like, Susan Orlean was very influential in that case. Like, the ordinary can always become extraordinary if you give someone enough time, you know, that everyone can be a fascinating character in person if you peel back enough layers. So I think having that in my head that, like, you know, even if you doesn't feel like you have a lot now, like, if you just, you know, spend some more time around someone. It's amazing what will come out of that.
Yeah, and I guess the danger to that is sometimes you might hide yourself, and more reporting and more research will lead to, yeah, eventually it's a way of procrastinating to, you know, eventually you have to get to the writing part. So when do you know, in your experience, when do you know that you're done reporting by and large?
Yeah, I mean, especially with this book project, I kind of kept reporting. I mean, I think that is a really hard part for me, is like to stop and to feel like you have enough. And I think with my process of, you know, coming home and being like, well, let me just write what I have right now, even though it doesn't feel like enough. But then once you start writing, you're like, okay, actually, you know, I do have a decent amount. And then just seeing where the holes are, just being like, okay, well, I have this and I have this, but it would be great to get more of this aspect of, you know. So for me, that was helpful in the process to just start writing, even though I didn't feel like I had enough and I could have kept reporting. So.
And what are maybe 3 to 5 books that you find yourself rereading again over and over as kind of a North Star, if you will?
Yeah, I mean, I already mentioned some of the writers, but yeah, like Joseph Mitchell, like Up in the Old Hotel, and Susan Orlean's The Orchid Thief, and she's just incredible with character development in that book. And then for this book, I read a lot of, like, I read Rebecca Skloot's Henrietta Lacks book a couple times, just to see her structure. She talks a lot about how she structured that book, and there were so many moving parts, and like, I think it spans like a decade of work that she did, and so just that was really helpful to kind of see this, you know, this book with a lot of different information and a lot of different characters and how she organized it. So I studied a lot of books that had, you know, the structure that I was imagining, like having these like narratives that you could weave together. I also actually, I love the Game of Thrones books by George R. R. Martin.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually really like the way he structures them, just with the different, you know, characters. He has so many different characters, but he's able to successfully like weave them together that you're engaged with them the whole time. So I used a lot of those types of books to help me with this one.
And what other artistic media do you like to consume that helps inform the writing you do?
Like podcasts, like This American Life and Radio Lab, and I like those. Some, documentary work. I think just even shows, just the way they, build suspense and keep you wanting to see the next show is almost like a chapter that you want to keep. You wrap some stuff up, but you leave some information to help build some suspense. So,
Yeah, like Stranger Things or Breaking Bad, a big takeaway I took from Breaking Bad, aside from the serialized nature of it and suspense and such, was how Vince Gilligan runs a writing room and how they go about putting the index cards up on the board. Like it comes across artful, the final product, but it is incredibly structured and very well thought out, to the point where they put those building blocks and then the writer then takes that cork board and then wrote the episode. So it's, it's like, in conversations I've had with a lot of people, it's like great art can, just because something is well structured and well thought out doesn't mean you can't make great art from it.
Right. Yeah.
It's like the boundaries are able to, working within constraints can sometimes free you up artistically.
Exactly. Yeah.
And do you find that if you had to say start over at age 25, is there anything that you've learned up to this point where you're like, oh, I wish I knew that then, and then that could have accelerated things for me a little more?
Yeah, I mean, what I was saying earlier, just with, wanting to do magazine feature writing, but not knowing exactly how to get there and thinking that, working in a magazine would be, I think it's hard because when you're just starting out, like, you immediately want to do this work and you don't, at least I didn't want to like take the time and the steps to really develop myself as a writer. I just wanted to be doing it immediately. So I think if I was to go back, I might just work at a newspaper or somewhere where you're just writing every single day, regardless of if you actually like the writing. I think that's really helpful to build those skills. Cause I think I started doing that a little later and I wish I'd just been doing it earlier to write something every single day, even if it's like tech writing or something that you're not excited about, but you can, still be developing a lot of skills that way.
Yeah. And with your writing features and stuff takes a bit of time, even if you're doing 1,000 or 1,500 word features, they still take several hours, even weeks. And I wonder how many features do you have going at a time, and how many pitches do you try to write per week? Just to give people an idea of what it takes to sustain a freelance career and features. Yeah.
I mean, it really varies, depending on what I have going on. And especially with the book, I didn't write a lot of other features. And now, I have, once you develop a connection, a relationship with an editor, it gets a lot easier. And, I can just, like my other Glamour, I send her a couple sentences about something I want to work on, versus writing an entire pitch. So I don't, like now I don't send out a lot of those long pitches anymore. At the beginning, I think I always have had like other things going on too, like either teaching or like in my 20s, I was doing dog sitting on top of writing. So just having like some sort of stability really helps me, like free me to pursue a story that like I might not make anything off of, but I'm really interested in it and passionate about it. So I think that's always helped me, having some sort of income or stability to help me do that.
Do you have something of that nature right now, or are you in a place where your writing is supporting you full time?
No, I teach now. I teach a night class and then do some substitute teaching as well. So I've always tried to have something.
I love hearing that, Blair, that, you know, that to hear you say, you know, you have this other, these other things kind of on the side that are just nice and steady that are gonna, you know, in the event that you're in a trough of, you know, freelance woes, you know,
right,
they just,
they always come, you know, they're like a,
and they can be a long,
I don't know anyone,
but, yeah, it's a long time. And even when you do get a check, a, such a big chunk of it is taxes and you don't get to keep that whole chunk. It's a whole lot of, you're paying a lot out of pocket, and it's nice. And I, you know, I don't hear a whole lot of people talk about that. So it's like, I thank you for at least, you know, even being forthcoming to say that you do have this extra thing on the side that you're doing just for that steadier income. Like I work pretty much full time at a bookstore as well, which you know, I do, you know, 40 hours there, but I'm also doing this and a lot of other, you know, the narrative type writing and freelancing that I do. So it's like, you know, you're doing that work that you're proud of, but sometimes on the side, you're doing this other thing to help subsidize it in a way. Right. So it's cool. Like, well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I also really like having work that I don't have to use my writing brain for, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, working at a bookstore would be nice that way, too. It's like, you can really focus all your energy and your creative, you know, energy onto that project that you want to do after work versus, you know, when I've had jobs where I've been writing a lot, I don't usually pursue my passion projects as easily. So,
yeah. As I, you know, wind down here and kind of let you get out of here and so forth, I'd just like to ask you, like, what excites you and what brings you back to the reporter notebook and really just excites you to the point where you want to dive in to, you know, pursue something longer? You know, what still gets you up out of bed in the morning when it comes to narrative journalism?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really hard question to answer right now because I just finished this book and I've been doing the book tour and kind of completely immersed in that, and it took a lot out of me to do this book. I mean, I feel pretty exhausted. So I know I'll get back there. You know, I always keep a journal, like a notebook with me and jot down ideas. But I think I'm just like, I think I need a little break. You know, I'm not pursuing any big stories right now. So I think I'll do some shorter pieces. But yeah, I think it's going to take me a little while to like get back into that in-depth narrative journalism that I love, simply because I feel a little like I, you know, used up all that energy working on this book for right now. So
yeah,
I know I'll get there again, but yeah, it's like, that's a tough question right now.
Oh, of course. Well, what do you like to do to unplug your writer brain? Like, what other activities do you like to do to, you know, get away from that to help recharge the batteries?
Anything outside really helps me. Reading, just like reading for fun, is also great. I think, you know, when I was working on the book, what really helped was doing some residencies, like where you go somewhere where there's very little internet connection, or there's like no cell phone reception, and having that be a space that you can just kind of sit with your own thoughts a lot. That's always really helped me.
Nice. And where can people find you online, Blair?
I have a website, blairbriody.com, or, you know, on Facebook or Twitter.
Okay. Yeah. So you're at, is it just at Blair Briody?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Fantastic. Well, Blair, thank you so much for jumping on the podcast, and you know, hopefully we'll resolve some of those tech issues. I know this last half is going to come out pretty damn well perfect, but we'll address anything else in the future. But have a happy Thanksgiving, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
You're welcome. Congratulations again. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk later.
That's a wrap on episode 77 with journalist Blair Brody. Congrats to her on the new book and for winning the contest for It Takes a Boom. As we have come to the end of the show, I ask if you dig the podcast, leave an honest review on iTunes. That offer from the top of the show still applies. And also, head over to BrendanOmara.com for show notes, as well as a chance to subscribe to my monthly newsletter. Yes, monthly. I give out my book recommendations for the month, as well as what you may have missed from the podcast. Once a month, no spam, you can't beat it. And you know what? And I will be right here next week for another conversation about creating works of nonfiction. Have a CNF and good week. Bye.